En mörk oändlig ängmark.
Welcome to Views from the World Tree. On this week's show, we're discussing Brandon Sanderson's most recent book called Tress of the Emerald Sea. And now, on with the show.
Yes, I see. Good news, everyone!
Greetings, everyone. I'm back, and just wanted to give updates on where I'm at with my reading right now. I'm still working on Brandon Sanderson's third book in his Mistborn trilogy, called The Hero of Ages, and I'll finish it someday, I promise. It's just little by little as I drive to and from work. I also finished Tress of the Emerald Sea this week, obviously for the deadline. And I have also still been playing a little bit of WoW, more a little bit of a Candy Crush kind of week where I just needed something more simple. I did have an entertaining moment this week with playing games with some of my students in my after school program. I was playing Heads Up, which is one of those like charades, acted out, guess it kind of games. And the kids got really loud and shouting and got a noise notification that the levels were so loud they would damage my hearing if it was continued for 30 minutes. So that was my entertaining moment of the week.
Fun. Well, for me, I am still making my way through my reading list of 100 books in 2023. I've finished 11. I'm currently reading Well of Ascension still on the Kindle, and then still listening to Off to Be the Wizard, which is the Magic 2.0 book number one, on Audible to go to sleep or on the rare occasion that I drive somewhere. As far as what I have been watching, nothing super exciting. We did start watching Critical Role's Campaign 3 again. We had been watching it a while ago and just started watching other things, and we've been back watching it again. Kind of got back in the mood, what with Season 2 of Vox Machina. And then as far as actual news, I don't have any news headlines this week. Everything that I've seen has been depressing, so not a whole lot to talk about.
All right, well, then I guess we're ready to jump into the book. I am super excited for today's book discussion. I have been a fan of Brandon Sanderson's books for a very long time. I actually started with one of his books, Elantris, and then Mistborn was the next book that I had read of his. And at that time, there really wasn't anything else out. Like, that was where it was at. And so I remember Well of Ascension coming out and Hero of Ages. And so this week we're going to talk about the most recent one. And it kind of ties a lot of things together. So let me give you a quick synopsis of what this book is about. So we'll do our best not to give any like major spoilers, but if you're into Brandon Sanderson's work and you're going to read Tress of the Emerald Sea, you may want to wait. This is your spoiler warning, and that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, we won't divulge any like big major plot points, but I would say there definitely will be spoilers.
Yeah. So this story follows Tress. She's a girl living on an island in the middle of an ocean of green spores, which is like pollen, and one of 12 oceans that covers her home planet. She's an impoverished window washer and an avid collector of cups. Tress is friends with Charlie, who pretends to be the groundskeeper for the Duke that rules the island, while in actuality is the Duke's son. Over time, Tress and Charlie realize that they have feelings for each other and confess them. Unfortunately, the Duke sees this and shortly after takes Charlie with him to other islands to try to marry him off to a princess. Before his departure, Charlie promises to fend off all the suitors and send Tress letters and cups. She receives four of them before Charlie falls silent. So when his ship returns, she ventures out to see what became of him. However, the Duke brings back a different heir, while Charlie appears to have disappeared completely. Tress investigates this and discovers that Charlie was sent off to marry the evil sorceress of the Midnight Sea and was subsequently captured. Despite the sorceress sending a ransom note, no one is interested in paying. Realizing that everyone but her has put Charlie out of their minds, Tress decides to set out and rescue him herself.
So a little bit of background on this book. There is a quote from the author where he kind of describes his idea for this world. He describes it as he had the idea for a world where people sail upon powder or dust instead of water. He used it as a way to start introducing the ethers to people as a Cosmere magic system. And as a basic premise, what if Buttercup were more proactive? Buttercup being a reference to the princess in The Princess Bride, which goes into more of the background of this book. Sanderson actually wrote this book in secret, not telling anybody except for his wife, Emily, for who it was a gift. Since he wasn't doing any book tours in 2020 due to the pandemic, he had a lot more writing time. And so he created Tress of the Emerald Sea, along with four other books. And the story was directly inspired by The Princess Bride. His wife, Emily, was dissatisfied with Princess Buttercup's passive attitude, asking why she sat and did nothing when her true love was kidnapped by pirates. So this gave Brannon the idea of writing a story similar in premise and in tone to The Princess Bride, but one in which the girl sets out to rescue her love. The book is set on the planet Lumar, which is a clever portmanteau of lunar and Mar, as in sea. It was a combination of two factors: Brandon's desire to introduce ethers into the Cosmere as a magic system, as well as his fascination with fluidization, which is the process by which granular matter like sand, or in this case pollen spores, can behave like a liquid under the right circumstances. So as far as the actual story method of delivery, functionally it's written in the form of a verbal story told by Hoyd, who is a recurring character in many of Sanderson's books. Very witty, very sarcastic character who kind of jumps between worlds and knows more about what's going on than the individual characters within each story within each world. So,
well, and I think one of the things that's just so cool about this is that he did write this project in secret, and that originally was not intending on publishing it. It was supposed to be just a gift for his wife. But then after she read it, she was like, no, this has got to be published. And I am so glad she convinced him, because I really did enjoy this book.
Yeah. So the format of this discussion is not going to be like a spoiler review where we go through chapter by chapter. What we thought would be more interesting and less spoilery. So we want to kind of encourage people to read the book rather than just tell them what happens. And so we're going to go through, you and I read this independently and we kind of marked passages that we liked. So we're going to go through in chapter order, and where there were specific passages that we highlighted, we're going to share a few quotes and talk about them, but we're not going to do like a point by point summary. So,
well, especially since at this point in time, most people have still not even received their hardcover or paper, like physical copies of the book.
That's true. Yeah.
So,
I think so. The first quote that we have highlighted was one that you were interested in. So Why don't you start?
This one's just kind of just a little quick one, and it kind of, there's two parts to it. It's one part's from the first chapter, one part's from the second chapter. And as we mentioned in our introduction to the book, that Tress loves cups. She collects cups. And sailors would bring her cups. And then specifically, Charlie starts bringing her the cups as well, or sending her the cups. And one of the quotes says, the cups they brought her were often battered and worn, but Tress didn't mind. A cup with a chip or ding in it had a story. And I just thought that was really cool. I know this can also be some fighting words between me and Adam, but I love books when they're worn out. I love seeing books that are well read, and because every, you know, little crinkle here and, you know, bent page there really like tells the story that somebody really has read this book over and over and over again. So I love that idea of a cup with a chip or a ding in it had a story. Like, it's not just, it's not damaged. Like, I like that idea of being able to look, and especially going into the story, that we're not looking at what are all the damages that are done, but let's look at the story.
Yeah. And for the record, I don't have anything against worn books. I like to have two copies. I like to have a nice, like, hardcover copy that's kept clean, and then another copy that I can, you know, read while I'm eating, and I don't care if stuff gets spilled in it. So
it's just different philosophies. So this then ties into the second part, which was in chapter 2, where it has kind of a similar idea and feeling. And at this point, Charlie and Tress are talking to each other, and they Charlie talked about the possibility of, you know, if Tress got captured by somebody, what would he do about it? And he said, if you did get captured, I'd help anyway. Because at this point, he's not a, you know, he's not a soldier. Like, and so he's still pretending to be the gardener. Gardener. he said, I'd help anyway. I'd put on armor, Tress, shining armor. Well, or maybe dull armor. I think if someone I knew were captured, I wouldn't take the time to shine the armor. Do you think those heroes pause to shine it when people are in danger? And again, this comes to that same idea. You and I have talked about this before, or Adam and I have talked about this before, about the idea of that knight in shining armor. And I've talked about the idea of, I have been grateful to find like a knight in dented armor, that he's been in battle. He knows what life is, and it's not just this perfect shiny armor that of someone who sat on the sidelines and watched. And so I loved that idea got brought up in here.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. My quote that I marked in chapter 2 was a lot less philosophical and deep. the quote that I marked was just because I thought it was funny. It says, in short, Tress was a normal teenage girl. She knew this because the other girls often mentioned how they weren't like everyone else. And after a while, Tress figured that the group everyone else must include only her. The other girls were obviously right, as they all knew how to be unique. They were so good at it, in fact, that they did it together. So this is just me being a cynical old fart that, you know, thinks it's funny when people rebel against societal norms to the extent that they're all identical. So, and I mean, I was a teenage rebel at one point, so I can't claim that, you know, I wasn't of the same school of thought. It's just kind of funny to me. So,
all right, well, let's move on to another one. I'll go ahead and read it for us, and then you can kind of start off with what your thoughts are about this one. Lem was not poor. He simply didn't have a lot of money. They remembered that time when Rod had been drunk and Lem had helped him home. And Jewel, when he'd lost his roof during the windstorm, Lem had helped build a new one. And these are just some town characters that they're talking about right now. And there
Lem is Tress's dad.
That's right. I did.
So a little bit of background. Lem is Tress's dad. Tress is trying to find a way off of the island to go try and rescue Charlie at this point. Nobody on the island is allowed to leave by order of the Duke. And so this is talking about Tress's dad, Lem.
Okay. All right. So there were, I'll just go back to the beginning. So now that we understand, Lem was not poor. He simply didn't have a lot of money. They remembered that time when Rod had been drunk and Lem had helped him home. And Jewel, when he'd lost his roof during the windstorm, Lem had helped him build a new one. There were dozens of similar stories. Lem was the human equivalent of a deep, pure well, always full of water when you needed it. He'd offer what you needed and ask nothing in return. In fact, he'd never bring it up again, unless it was urgent, unless it was important. In those cases, well, Lem might have been poor in the kind of currency that paid taxes, but he was downright wealthy when it came to the kind of currency that mattered. Word got around that night. Lem needed something, specifically from Gremmy, Soar, and Brick. Lem, the man with no debt, needed this favor so badly, he almost asked for it. In the language of men like these, that's the equivalent of begging. Decisions were reached, but not spoken. They didn't need to be, for the next morning, too early for any of them, Tress found the barkeep, the dockmaster, and the dock worker on her doorstep. They demanded to help her in whatever she was doing.
So this is, I highlighted this because it's kind of a portrait or an archetype of man, woman, whatever, that doesn't exist anymore. Like just that kind of quiet, stoic person who helps others. They watch for what others need and go out of their way to help them without ever expecting anything in return. And then, you know, when the time comes that they need help, it's nice to see that in this community, that kind of understanding was fostered where it was like, okay, well, Lem is always helping everybody. Now he needs help. And so you have all of these people turning up to be like, how can we, like, this is finally our chance to pay you back. How can we help you? And I think I also marked it because this is kind of the way that I was raised. Like I see in this description of Lem, I see a lot of my dad and like how he would always go out of his way to serve other people, never ask for anything in return, just, doing it because it was the right thing to do. So I thought that was cool. I think we need more of that in this world. We need more instances of people who serve and help out others just because that's what should be done. You know, you don't always have to expect payment.
Yeah. And I love that idea that, they pointed out that money is not always what makes people wealthy, and that he was wealthy in the currency that mattered. And like you said, it's that social connection, that desire and care for other people around you.
Yeah. And it also is, I guess I touched on this a little bit, but one of the other notes that I specifically put is it drives me crazy when people put effort into a relationship only when they need something. Like you and I have talked about this. I'm sure a lot of other people have seen it, right? You have like an old friend on Facebook or social media or whatever that all of a sudden sends you a message for the first time in 10 years. And they're like, hey, how's it going? And almost without fail, it's because they need something from you. Like people just don't reach out to say hi anymore. People don't put the effort in to maintain those connections. And so it makes it a lot harder to want to help people when they come and ask you for help, when that's the only time they ever come to you. If the only time somebody comes to you is when they need something, eventually, I've had friendships that have completely dissolved because I just not interested in dealing with those kind of people anymore. If you're not going to put in the effort, you know, when you don't need something, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in helping you just because you need something.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like in the advent of social media, how we can be connected in so many ways to people that sometimes it fosters the connections to people that we don't necessarily, or that we normally wouldn't have maintained a connection to.
Yeah.
And sometimes eventually those people come back stronger in our lives and become the people that aren't just coming for help.
Yeah,
definitely. And, but then, you know, some of these other people who've always been there for us or were always there for us, you know, change, it shifts and it becomes where it, you don't message them one day and all of a sudden you realize it's been years since you've talked to them. And so that can definitely happen if you don't pay attention to the people around you and really try to foster and build those relationships.
Yeah, agreed.
I had another thought from this chapter that I thought was interesting. And they were talking about the evenings at the tavern. And it said, evenings at the tavern, as you know, are like fires in a hearth. They live two lives. There's the part where they're roaring, festive, and cheerful. Then the evening begins to drift. The tavern becomes colder, darker, and quieter. Those who populate the tavern during its second life don't want companionship, just company. And I thought, kind of along the same lines of just talking about building those relationships with the people around you, it made me think of that idea that when we really know what other people need and want, sometimes it's not about talking to them to fix their problem. That sometimes it's just strictly just being there for them in those dark, quiet moments, letting them have somebody to just be with them so they're not alone.
I don't think my fire ever roars. It's never festive or cheerful. My fire is always dark and smoldery. So I'm going to skip the quote that I had highlighted in part three and jump to part five, chapter 36. And this is where I started to, like, if you look at my copy of the ebook, it's like highlight here, highlight here, highlight here. This is where everything kind of started to come together. And so the first one is from chapter 36. This is, I don't think that we really need any background from this necessarily. So I'll just read it. It says, memories have a way of changing on us, souring or sweetening over time, like a brewery drink, then recreate later by taste, only getting the ingredients mostly right. You can't taste a memory without tainting it with who you have become. That inspires me. We each make our own lore, our own legends every day. Our memories are our ballads. And if we tweak them a little with every performance, well, that's all in the name of good drama. The past is boring anyway. We always pretend the ideals and culture of the past have aged like wine. But in truth, the ideas of the past tend to age more like biscuits. They simply get stale. And I know you had highlighted that one too, so. So when I was reading this, I thought back to an article that I was reading where, neuroscientists have actually theorized that just the act of remembering a memory actually has chemical, like physiological changes in the brain that affect how that memory is recalled the next time. So I'm curious what you think. Do you feel that this is true? Do you feel that? I guess first, do you feel like we remember the past sometimes with the quote rose tinted glasses? Or do you find that that's not necessarily the case?
One of the things that I thought about was with the changes in how we see things. I had a therapist once talk about how when we look back on a situation, we tend to judge that situation by who we are now. And so we don't always, you know, we look at it with what we know now and forget what we didn't know then. And so I think there is that possibility of memories changing on us because we might not care about a different part of the memory anymore. And so it becomes forgotten. So I think that's pretty possible that there is changes in how the memories are stored. What about, like, what is your thought on that with the, you know, is it rose colored glasses or the hardships?
I mean, I think there's some truth to it. I don't know if it's, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist. I don't really understand all of that, but I think this is something definitely that I've seen with my past and my memories. I mean, there's definitely very negative parts of my past that I don't really remember at all, which is kind of a type of seeing it through rose-colored glasses, because it's just some things are blocked out. But I also have other memories that, you know, if I really sit and think about it, I'm like, okay, yeah, maybe it wasn't quite as good as it seemed. There's a quote later on, I think it's one that's marked, about our memories, like from when we were kids specifically, and how we have really fond memories of our childhood, but like if you really stop to think about it, there was hardship. Like there was, you know, trials and difficulties, and I mean, something that's on a lot of people's mind right now is money problems and like recession. I said the R word, and all of that stuff. But if I think back to my childhood, like that was a big deal growing up at the time we did. There was a lot of economic problems in this country. You and I just don't remember because we were little kids. So anyway, I think
that's because we choose to focus on what's important to us. So right. As a kid, you know, we're more excited about, you know, who we were playing with, what game we were enjoying, and, mm-hmm. you know, different things. I think on that same line, like a lot of times people get focused on their glory moments as well. And so just that opposite, like, I think we see those extremes, and I kind of liked that idea of age, you know, comparing it to aged wine versus aged biscuits. Like people look for, you know, people who drink they want the drink that's been aged more because it has that stronger flavor. And, you know more about it than I do. I really don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to wine, but I definitely know what I'm talking about when it comes to stale biscuits. So biscuits, it was good at one point, but if it just sits there and it doesn't change and you don't do something with it, it gets stale. And I think that happens often with our lives where we have big moments like high school, or, it could be like a, experience where you go on some trip, or just any sort of like large experience that we often spend our time reliving that and always sharing things from that, because that was like our powerful moment, instead of looking at all the other moments that have come since then. And so those stories get old, they get stale when they're repeated over and over again. And so I think being able to look at things new and find new opportunities can help, not just reliving the old moments. And like on that same note, that between those good memories and those bad memories, they don't always match who we are now. And so sometimes we can be bitter about some of those memories that we might have, but we can look back and remember the moment for what it was at the time, which was often like a joyous occasion or happy memories.
Yeah, agreed. I don't really have a whole lot to add that I didn't already say.
All right. Let's. For this next one, I really connected with Tress on this moment. So this chapter was called The Scholar. And so, which kind of gives you that idea of, you know, it's focusing on what she's studying and learning. And I loved this description. It said where she had read, now she studied, where she had arranged, now she organized, and where she had accepted, now she experimented. Nothing motivates quite like a deadline, particularly one that emphasizes the dead part. And I totally related with her on this one. I am a serial procrastinator. Nothing motivates me better than a deadline, and have spent many a late night getting things done because I procrastinated more than I should have. But I just, you know, I loved Sanderson's choices of words. I work a lot with trying to teach students to use the right word, like really use the word that tells what you're trying to do. And I love how he pointed out the difference between reading and studying, arranging, organizing, accepting, experimenting. I love that idea. And then on that same note of how it feels to be a scholar and study, she gets interrupted. And she points out, it says, a polite one of the type Tress associated with her old life. Nonetheless, it shattered Tress's concentration like the thunder of 1,000 cannons firing at once. She was strangely reluctant to leave her research. That was silly. She had no formal training in academics. Her schooling had ended at basic reading and arithmetic. Surely she wasn't secretly a scholar. A window washing girl? If she'd been inclined toward research, she would have realized it before. And the truth was, she'd simply never encountered a topic interesting enough or dangerous enough to engage her. And I just really, again, related with that. Like, when I am focused on something I love, like, the world is to doubt. And so how easily it is for us to be interrupted that we lose that hyper-focus. And so it was just, for me, a really nice moment of being able to connect with a character and know that I am not alone.
So I'm going to back up to your first quote in chapter 37. The part I like about that is it says, where she had accepted, now she experimented. And I have always been, well, not always, maybe not when I was younger. I was very accepting of what I was told when I was younger. But as I've matured, that's something I've tried to take to heart, is not just accepting what other people say, like having the curiosity to question, you know, what some people take for granted, question the information that you're presented with until you have evidence that it's true. So I really liked that. And then the other thing with your comment about her concentration and having it just be like completely shattered. So I write software, and there was a really interesting study that one of my previous managers shared with me, where they looked at people who were, and it was a software company that did the, that was writing the article. So I'm sure it's true of other things too, but when you're super hyper-focused and engaged and you're writing code, somebody can come and ask you a question, and that interruption can take as little as, you know, 15 seconds. But for you to re-engage and remember where you were and what, like, your train of thought, can take an average of 20 minutes. So a distraction of just a few seconds can cost you 20 minutes of productivity, which is just insane to think about. But at the same time, like, I've experienced that, and it, like, yeah, it is very damaging. So I can sympathize with Tress.
I remember you actually telling me about that article a couple of years ago. And I remember thinking that that's like one of the things I struggle so much with being a teacher, is some of my prep times are barely 20 minutes. And so if the average time for somebody to get concentrated and get back into it is 20 minutes, no wonder I can't get things done.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go on to another quote. There's just so many good things in this book. Continuing on that idea of being open and experimenting, she mentioned, she says at one point, what else would she have never known about herself if she hadn't left her home island? Worse, how many people like her lived in ignorance, lacking the experience to fully explore their own existence? It is one of the most bitter ironies I've ever had to accept. There are unquestionably musical geniuses of incomparable talent who died as street sweepers because they never had the chance to pick up an instrument. I just think about this, like, what opportunities do we miss in our own lives when we are afraid to take chances? And it's so easy to just let chances pass us by. But, like, I think about, you know, and I'm sorry to, like, make all these connections with teaching, but that's, you know, my life. It's what I live every day. But I work with kids that are, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And I just, like, I want each of them to have all the possible successes in the world. And but it's so hard to get people to look at that stepping out of that comfort zone.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of my comfort zone. So initially when I was listening to you read this quote, I was thinking of, because I come from a very small town. It's a mining town. It's one of those towns where a lot of people never leave. You know, they're born, they go to school, they go right into working, and then they retire, you know, they have kids, they die, all in the same little town. And at first I was thinking, you know, it's kind of sad that they aren't able to, you know, leave their home island, like the quote says. And then I started thinking about myself and I'm like, well, but like, I've seen the world. I've moved several times. I've lived, you know, we moved out of state, and yet I really yearn for that, like, small, tight knit community, you know, small town, homesteading type life. And I realized that's the difference though. So the quote specifically says, it specifically talks about people living in ignorance. And I think that's the difference, is you do have some people who are ignorant and refuse to learn about the outside world. You know, they have such narrow views. They have the same politics that their parents did and their grandparents did. They never question their suppositions. They never try and shift and challenge their paradigms. They just do it because that's how it's always been done. And that's very different from somebody who, you know, goes and looks and has that curiosity and challenges preconceptions and then decides, okay, here's what I was taught. Here's what I've learned. What I want my life to be is this other, like, combination. And you pick and choose the good parts from all of these different walks of life. So.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that as well. I've seen a, you know, a comparison with that in higher education. I have gone to more colleges than I can count on one hand. And so I've experienced lots of different colleges. And so a lot of people only experience like a 4-year college if they go to college. And I, you know, people will ask my advice and I always suggest that idea of, you know, consider doing a 2-year college, consider doing, you know, experimenting, trying, looking at different things, because you really don't know what you want until you can experience some of the different things and see what options are out there.
Yeah. So I am going to skip my quote for chapter 39, because we're already at 40 minutes. I'm going to go to my quote from chapter 42. This is another one. So a lot of these quotes in the later half of the book that we've marked are from the narrator. And since he has that kind of outside perspective, you know, where he knows more than just this world, they don't really need a lot of explanation. So, so in chapter 42, the narrator is thinking about memory. This is the one I was talking about earlier. It says, memory is often our only connection to who we used to be. Memories are fossils, the bones left by dead versions of ourselves. It's beautiful imagery. More potently, our minds are a hungry audience craving only the peaks and valleys of experience. The bland erodes, leaving behind the distinctive bits to be remembered again and again. Painful or passionate, surreal or sublime, we cherish those little rocks of peak experience, polishing them with the ever-smoothing touch of recycled proxy living. In so doing, like pagans praying to a sculpted mud figure, we make of our memories the gods which judge our current lives. We must take care not to let the bliss of the present fade when compared to supposedly better days. We're happy, sure, but were we more happy then? If we let it, memory can make shadows of the now, as nothing can match the buttressed legends of our past. Do not let memory chase you. Enjoy memories, yes, but don't be a slave to who you wish you once had been. Those memories aren't alive. You are. So this is kind of another like recurring theme that I saw in this book, right? The narrator Hoyd talks a lot about the danger of being so nostalgic that we misremember it, and it affects our current lives because we're so focused on the past, which you were talking about a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. This, I think, is, like you said, the theme of the book of just like living, learning to live with who you are and enjoy. And he makes this effort in several of his books with Journey Before Destination, that we need to look at how we are living and what is the journey that we're on to really live life to its fullest.
Yeah. The other thing, or the other reason I highlighted this is because we do talk a lot about mindfulness on this podcast. And one of the main tenets or the main schools of thought of mindfulness is all about living in the moment, not worrying about the future to the point of anxiety, not longing for the past to the point of depression. What are your thoughts about living in the moment? Have you found that to be beneficial, or maybe if there's strategy that you found to help you focus on the moment? Because these guys have heard me talk about living in the moment, and you know, they're sick of me talking about it.
I think it's definitely for me something I'm still learning how to do. I think it's a process that I'm on, trying to learn how to be more focused on what's right now and being able to let go of the past and not being anxious for the future. And just looking at what my life is and enjoying what I have. I think, you know, it can be easy to let, you know, well, like I had pointed out earlier, you know, I think this is where it tied, the looking at the memories for what they are and not, you know, being overly bitter or overly happy about them, so that we can focus on what it is and what we are currently doing. Does that kind of answer that question, I think?
Yeah, that was great. Great answer.
I did want to point out with this quote as well, I do feel like this was such a great example of just some of the writing from Sanderson that I just love his imagery, mm-hmm. and his use of words and just how thoughtful it had to have been to really phrase out all of these things to, you know, make those connection to the bones left and the connections of like painful or passionate, surreal or sublime, we cherish them, you know? And so I just love his way with words.
Yeah. His grasp of imagery is very Tolkien-esque. It makes use of a lot of metaphor. And then, so I minored in English. And so that part of my brain is like picking out things like the alliteration in that second paragraph, right? Painful or passionate, surreal or sublime. Just all of the little things that, he's definitely a very good writer. I'm also going to skip my quote from chapter 43 and jump into my one from chapter 44,
okay.
Just in the interest of time. So just this one does need a little bit of background. The narrator in his characteristic brand of humor at the beginning of the book decided to refer to all of the non-main characters by the name of Doug. So all of the, you know, the different hands, the different sailors on the ship where the bulk of the story takes place, he said that he's just going to refer to them as Doug. So the quote is, again, from Hoyd, the narrator, "I implied that I didn't remember the names of the Dougs. That was a lie. I wanted to keep your focus on the main players of this particular story. But every person has a story, Dougs included. The one who died was named Paxson. Both he and his sister were Dougs on the Crow's Song. Paxson was tall and awkward on land, the type of man who seemed to have been born with legs a size too large for his torso. He was bald, despite his relative youth, and his neck kind of merged with his chin, to the point that after meeting him, you'd inexplicably get a hankering for a baguette. He was also unaccountably kind. He was the man who had kept checking on Tress as she clung to the side of the ship. He'd held the rope with several others as Fort pulled her up. He'd always laughed at meals and thanked Fort for the food, no matter how bad it had tasted. He loved music, but couldn't play, and had always secretly regretted never learning. I wish I'd been in a state of mind to give him lessons. Now he had fallen. We gave his corpse to the spores and sailed onwards. Tress felt responsible. Maybe if the ship had waited a few more months out in the Verdant, they wouldn't have encountered the rains that day. She was terrified that Paxson wouldn't be the only casualty of her recklessness." So, a couple of things to unpack here. Questions for you. Every person has a story, even unimportant background characters. And if it wasn't for Paxson, this entire story would have been over after a few chapters. So question one, what are your thoughts on that and the importance of, you know, people that don't get like the Nobel Prize and stuff like that? Second point, what do we do when our decisions interact with tragedies? When we start asking those what if questions, right? What if I had left home sooner? What if I had driven a little faster? What if I had done this or that? Could this tragedy have been prevented? Kind of that survivor's guilt. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on those two points?
It's definitely a real feeling, you know, that we have those questions. We're human. We want to know if we could change, you know, if we had done something differently. We want to prevent tragedy whenever we can. We really do. But we never know what's actually going to happen. You know, that's why they say hindsight's 20/20, you know, looking back on the situation, you know what happens. Like, you know, all the pieces that fell together to make it happen. But I think that's part of the key is it wasn't one thing that came together to make it happen. You know, it's a lot of different moving parts and pieces that come together for everything. And this also was, again, another common theme, I feel like, for this story, because we talked about it at the very beginning. You know, all these citizens in the town came together to help her get what she needed because her father had been such a great man. And there's other quotes in this story, too, about, you know, just that coming together and recognizing that a specific decision is also other decisions behind that. We're quick to judge people around us. We're quick to, you know, see a family in the grocery store and see a child throwing a tantrum and think, you know, some people are quick to think, oh, you know, like they're spoiling their child. They're such, you know, they make their judgments, but like we don't know the story behind it. You know, maybe that child used to not even be able to walk into a store because it was too overwhelming. And it was a miracle that they were able to get them to go with them into the store. You know, we never know what's behind the story. And I love that spot that you just pointed that out with Paxson, that if it wasn't for Paxson, this entire story would have been over after a few chapters. Mm-hmm. And we never know effect that we're going to have on other people. It, you know, for this book, it's life changing, but yet we didn't even know he had a name until he died, you know? And so I think that's something so incredible to know that our impact can be a lot greater than we realize. And at the same time, there's a lot of things that impact us that, you know, we can't control everything.
Yeah. And just, again, I don't want to dwell on this too much, but one quick comment. You mentioned we didn't even know his name until he died. I think that's an unfortunate reality that we see in the real world today, where some tragedy will happen, somebody will die, and that's when we find out who they are. That's when we find out the story of, like, you know, maybe the challenges that they had been dealing with. Sometimes those people are people that we actually know, and we just didn't know that they were dealing with things. And anyway, I guess that's just, I'm just saying that it's something that that happens, that, you know, people aren't recognized until after the tragedy. And I wish that, and I'm as guilty of it as anybody, but I wish we could, you know, get to know people and recognize people and acknowledge their achievements and their struggles before it gets to that point. So, hey, listeners, Adam from the present here. Just need to interrupt past Adam for a quick minute. As I was sitting down to edit this episode, there was just too much to fit into one, 45 to an hour time slot. So I decided we're going to split this episode into two parts. This will be the end of the first part of the book discussion. We'll move on to the mindfulness moment here in a second. And then the rest of the book discussion will come out in a week. Thanks. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to the mindfulness moment. So we are actually recording this on Burns Night. Which, if you don't know what that is, Robert Burns is the National Bard of Scotland. And so he is celebrated on January 25th each year by eating haggis, tatties, and neeps, which is potatoes and turnips, and drinking scotch. And so for the mindfulness moment, I thought we would read one of his more famous poems. I would say the most famous one is probably Auld Lang Syne, the song that everybody sings at New Year's. This is not that. and so he wrote it in Scots, which is a lesser known language, but it is a separate language from English. And so I figured I will try to read it in Scots. So I'll read a verse and then you can read the English version.
Oh, I'm definitely glad you are attempting the Scots. I do not do accents.
I'm not doing an accent. I just, I think that would be insulting. But so the poem is called To a Mouse on Turning Her Up in Her Nest with the Plow, dated November 1785. So this is, as I said, a Scots language poem written by Robert Burns in 1785. According to legend, he was plowing the fields and accidentally destroyed a mouse's nest, which it would need to survive the winter. His brother claimed that he composed the poem while he was still plowing. So, all right. There is, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 verses. Try not to make this take too long. If you want to fast forward, I will not be offended at all. So, we sleekit cowrin timrus beastie. Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou need na start away sa hasty, wi bickering brattle. I wad be laith to rin and chase thee, wi murdering paddle.
Little cunning, cowering, timorous beast, oh, what a panic is in your breast. You need not start away so hasty, with bickering prattle. I would loathe to run and chase you, with murdering paddle.
I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union, and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal.
I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes you startle at me, your poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal.
I doubt no wiles, but thou may thieve. What then, poor beastie, thou main live? A daemon eker in a thrave, a small request, I'll get a blessing with the lave, and never missed.
I doubt not sometimes that you may thieve. What then, poor beast, you must live? An odd ear in 24 sheaves is a small request. I will get a blessing with what is left and never miss it. I will get a blessing.
Thy wee bit housey too in ruin, it's silly, was the winds are strewin', and naething now too big a new inn, o foggage green, and bleak December's winds and swin, baith snell and keen.
Your small house too in ruin, its feeble walls the winds are scattering, and nothing now to build a new one. Of coarse green foliage, and bleak December's winds ensuing, both bitter and piercing.
Thou saw the fields laid bare and waste, and weary winter coming fast, and cozy here beneath the blast, thou thought to dwell, till crash, the cruel coulter passed, out throw thy cell.
You saw the fields laid bare and empty, and weary winter coming fast, and cozy here beneath the blast, you thought to dwell, till crash, the cruel coulter passed out through your cell.
Thy wee bit heap o' leaves and stibble has cost thee mony a weary nibble. Now thou's turned out for a' thy trouble, but house or hauled to thole the winter's sleety dribble and cranroach cold.
That small heap of leaves and stubble has cost you a many weary nibble. Now you are turned out for all your trouble, without house or holding, to endure the winter's sleety dribble and hoar frost cold.
But, Mousy, thou art no thy lane, improving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes, O mice and men, gang aft agley, and lay us naught but grief and pain for promised joy.
But, Mouse, you are not alone, improving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes of mice and men go oft awry, and leave us nothing but grief and pain for promised joy.
Still thou art blessed, compared with me. The present only toucheth thee. But och, I backward cast me eye on prospects drear, and forward though I canna see, I guess and fear.
Still you are blessed, compared with me. The present only touches you. But oh, I backward cast my eye on prospects dreary, and forward though I cannot see, I guess and fear.
I would like to apologize to anybody that's listening that speaks Scots or that lives in Scotland. I did my best. So I think as far as mindfulness goes, our whole episode was pretty mindful. This was probably the least mindful part. but because of the holiday, I figured it was appropriate. So.
All right, until next time, next week we will pick up where we left off with our discussion on Tress. It definitely got lots more to talk about.
Yeah, it gets really philosophical in the second half, so make sure you check that one out. We'll see you next week.